larger to me, and quite wild. A small mole marked the lower left side of his nose, and another mole, slightly larger, hung from the right eyebrow, a bit over the eye cavity. Near that, the dog bite scar from childhood remained over his right eye, his nose hooked down a little. A thick vein on the side of his neck and another on his temple bulged and throbbed when he was angry. During anger, his right eye looked murkier than the other, more dangerous. Sometimes while writing in his study or working on a project in his shop, he would place a pencil in the notch over one ear, forgetting it was there afterward and walking all around the house like that. At other times he shoved his eyeglasses high on his head into his hair to get them out of the way while keeping them handy. He used his head to hold things. If there had been a ledge on his forehead, it might have been stocked with office supplies. Mom often spoke of how strong he was. A natural strength, she said, from sturdy Herbert genes. He'd been a tough kid, and was even tougher now. No one pushed him around. He knew judo, a form of Japanese jiu-jitsu that he had learned in the service. I know he had a powerful grip, because whenever he was displeased, I found myself squirming in his cow milker hands, unable to free myself. He could open any jaw in an instant, and had what Mom called asbestos skin, enabling him to touch hot pans and casserole dishes without burning himself. His presence was overpowering, with more than a hint of police militarism, stemming from his highway patrolman father. When Dad questioned me, it was with intensity, the way the police did it. I was overpowered, mentally and physically. His commands boomed forth and were to be followed without question. My father often wore aviator sunglasses and military surplus clothes, especially shirts and coats, and he had other military items, including a U.S. Navy lie detector that he would use on me later, army chests, knives, a Navy periscope, a hand-operated field generator, and an old army sword with a green handle. As further evidence of his authority, he had handguns, rifles, and shotguns, which he used for hunting and target practice. He had a great deal of mechanical skill, in large part from the influence of his own father. Dad worked on our cars, performing a wide range of servicing and repairs. If he wasn't sure how to correct a particular mechanical problem, he would obtain the diagnoses of two or three mechanics. Then, when he was certain of the answer, he would perform the repairs himself. It was a technique he employed in order to survive on a limited budget, and he passed it on to Howie. My parents rarely made any markings in books, not even in pencil. Books were considered sacred. When doing research for his freelance writing, Dad was usually careful to make notes on slips of yellow typing paper, folded vertically and kept between the pages of the books. Frequently, these sheets of notepaper were the second sheets put in a typewriter under a sheet he was typing upon, done in order to protect the platen from the hard, sharp strikes of the keys. After a while, these second sheets had indentations on them from key strikes, and on these rough sheets my father made some of his notes. Undoubtedly, this had to do with a pack rat aspect of his personality, from having been raised during the Depression. Nothing was ever wasted. Late in 1952, to augment his income as a reporter, Dad took a part-time job as an early morning news announcer with KSRO, a station owned by the Press Democrat. It was 1,350 kilocycles on the radio dial, and sometimes Mom and I listened to him. His voice was strong and clear on the air. Since Sonoma County was a prime agricultural region and nearby Petaluma was famous for chickens and eggs, much of the news concerned egg and poultry prices and production levels. He also interviewed farm advisors and other local notables and gave weather reports. If he spoke of political issues, he sometimes laced the news with commentary. One morning, Dad arrived at KSRO so early that only he and the engineer were there. The engineer was a great big guy who loved to play practical jokes on announcers. He would put pictures of naked women in with the news copy, or a wet sponge on the announcer's chair, those sorts of things. Finally, Dad had endured enough of this, and decided to get even. From inside a glass-enclosed broadcast booth one morning, with the engineer sitting outside, Dad read the news over the air. Suddenly, in mid-sentence, he began mouthing words without uttering a sound. Intermittently, he would start talking again, cutting in and out. The engineer went crazy, waving his arms wildly and pounding on the glass. Dad just waved to him innocently. After the broadcast, the engineer was extremely upset, saying he would have to spend 8 to 10 hours tearing the transmitter apart to repair an intermittent in it. "What would you give not to have to tear it apart?" Frank Herbert asked. "Anything," the fellow said.
"Anything?"
"Yeah, sure."
"Okay,"
Dad said with a smile. "I got you." He then told the fellow what he had done, and exacted a promise from him to play no more practical jokes. The engineer kept his word. While the Sonoma County experiences were a treasure trove for future works, Dad didn't write much other than newspaper articles during the 3 years we lived there. One short story written in Santa Rosa was important because it was his first science fiction sale. Looking for Something appeared in the April 1952 edition of Startling Stories. In this piece, he described a world that was in reality an illusion created by a hypnotist. His only other publication during our years in Sonoma County was a limited edition book published by the Press Democrat, also in 1952. Entitled Survival and the Atom, it was a collection of Dad's articles on nuclear energy, with a press run of 750 copies. This formed an early link in the chain that would ultimately make him an anti-nuclear, anti-war activist. Chapter 7. The Newsman and Captain Video. My father met many famous people by doing newspaper stories on them, and a number would become lifelong friends. One was the political artist Bernard Zackheim, and later it would be the world-renowned Zen master Alan Watts. Another was the noted science fiction and fantasy author Jack Vance. Dad knew Vance's work, and late in 1952, he learned that the writer was living on a small farm not far from us, just outside of Kenwood, California. The reporter was on his way. Vance, while the same age as Frank Herbert, was much farther along in his career at the time. He had sold many short stories to the science fiction pulps, including his well-known Magnus Ridolf tales. He was also making good money writing scripts for the Captain Video television show, a popular half-hour program that ran 5 days a week. It was sponsored by Post Toasties cereal. In the show, the hero wore a silver helmet, and whenever he flew through the air, it was possible to see the wire that held him up. Jack lived on a small farm with his wife Norma and drove a bright yellow Jeepster convertible. A large, scholarly man with thinning hair, Jack wore eyeglasses that had thick, round lenses. He was intense and could be gruff, but his coarse outer shell was frequently employed as a shield, preventing prying eyes from peering into his private world. The real Jack Vance, if he permitted anyone to see that, was generous and effusive, an exceedingly nice man. Soon the men were talking of living together in Mexico and of joint writing projects. This was the opportunity of a lifetime for my father, to work and study with a successful writer. Jack Vance was far better off financially than we were. To save for the trip, Dad scrambled even more to augment his income. In ensuing weeks, he took every extra photography assignment he could get. He increased his hours at KSRO Radio, and whenever he could fit it in, he worked as an assistant to Irene Slattery in her private psychiatry practice. But his ex-wife Flora sued him, and a stipulation was entered by the court under which the plaintiff and defendant agreed to compromise the amount of past due support payments. The required payments and attorney fees added to our financial pressures. We had a 1950 Hillman in those days, a little four-door sedan that got excellent gas mileage. In an era of big cars and low-cost fuel, Dad predicted that most people in the world would drive economy cars one day, forced to do so by petroleum shortages and high fuel prices. Petroleum is a finite resource, he said. He put the Hillman up for sale to raise funds to apply toward purchase of a Jeep station wagon with the Vances for the Mexico trip. One evening, while I was riding in the back seat of the Hillman, our car was hit by another, knocking us into a ditch. The other car, a big sedan, kept going, a hit and run. I remember Dad shouting out the window and swearing, kicking our car when it lay damaged in the ditch. The other vehicle had administered a glancing blow against the side of our car, denting the doors on that side. Fortunately, none of us were injured. But the accident created big problems for us. Our auto insurance had lapsed for non-payment, and since the guilty driver had disappeared, we had no hope of receiving payment from him or his insurance company. Dad didn't want to spend his Mexico money repairing the car, and now, in its damaged condition, the vehicle couldn't be sold. It ran, but rattled badly. The damaged doors didn't open, and one of the windows on that side was broken away, letting air in all the time. Mom and Dad had taken out a loan on the Hillman from a Santa Rosa bank, but because of our credit problems, the bank had required additional guarantees. Dad had the Press Democrat as a co-signer on the car. After the accident, he and Mom stopped sending in car payments and instead applied all available money to their other bills and to their Mexico fund. About the time we were on the way to Mexico with the Vances in a new Jeep station wagon, paid for by the Vances, the Press Democrat was discovering that they owed money on a badly dented 1950 Hillman. Several years later, when Dad got back on his feet financially, he telephoned the Press Democrat and, in a long, jovial conversation, made arrangements to pay them back with interest. When my father decided to do something, he didn't allow anything to get in his way. And while he had his lapses in paying money he owed, be it to the Press Democrat, his ex-wife, or a variety of bill collectors, he invariably made amends later and repaid every cent. We received a battery of typhus, typhoid, and cholera shots for the Mexico trip and shopped for necessities we didn't expect to find in Mexico. Most of our possessions were left in storage with the Slatteries. By September 1953, we were on the road. 11-year-old Penny, since she lived most of the year with her mother, did not accompany us. The Vance's Jeep wagon was blue, with a top rack, and the men alternated driving duties. Mom kept a close accounting of our expenditures in a ledger book. Initially, I couldn't utter a word of Spanish, but I practiced on the way, and soon, at the age of 6, I was speaking the language fluently. When we arrived in Mexico, I was assailed with tropical colors and rich, earthy odors such as I had never before experienced. Tropical downpours were new to me, too. Sometimes the rain came down so hard that we had to pull the car over and wait for it to stop. I recall winding roads, green terraced hillsides of crops rising steeply beside the highway, and a treacherous river crossing we made on a one-car ferry, where the bridge had been washed out in a flood. Once, after several hot hours of driving in the interior of the country, we came to a promontory on top of a hill, where our eyes were suddenly filled with the breathtaking blue of the Gulf of California. Just north of Mazatlan, in the state of Sinaloa, we stopped for a break at a roadside monument that marked the Tropic of Cancer. Norma placed her purse on the front fender of the car and forgot it was there. A few miles down the road, with Jack driving, she suddenly missed it, and we made a quick U-turn. When we arrived back at the monument, we saw the purse on the ground. It had been run over. Inside, Jack's favorite writing instrument, a fountain pen, was ruined. Since Jack did his writing by longhand, this was a serious matter indeed. His favorite writing instrument felt right in his grip and disseminated ink perfectly. With it, he had written a number of excellent stories. The pen, silver and black, now lay crushed beside a Mexican highway. A short while later, we arrived in the seaside resort city of Mazatlan and checked into an old hotel on the southern end of the Great Crescent forming the bay. A massive seawall stood across the street from our hotel, with a wonderful sandy beach there. The insects, large and black, were either flying in my face or lying dead on the beach and seawall. I paid them little heed while Mom took care to avoid them. As Bruce and I played in the sand, she drew in her sketchbook. Later, as we sat together on the seawall, she taught me how to draw a house in perspective, as her artistic mother Marguerite had instructed her. The following day, we set off for points farther south. Near Guadalajara in the state of Jalisco, we rented a large house in the village of Chapala, on the shore of beautiful Lake Chapala. Famous for its fishing, pleasant climate, and scenery, it was the largest lake in Mexico, approximately 50 miles long and 15 miles wide. At an elevation of 5,000 feet, it had a number of small islands in its midst, and four villages around the rim, including Chapala. The region had numerous farms, growing subsistence crops, such as alfalfa, beans, corn, and maguey. A fishing village and artists' colony, Chapala was much favored by tourists, especially Americans. The town, while small, boasted one of the world's great beer gardens, a large tavern by the lake that had outdoor seating under a shady, striped canvas roof. On hot days, my parents and the Vances could be found there, cooling themselves in the shade. Sunsets on the lake were spectacular. Small fishing skiffs, some with butterfly nets extended, crossed the water from early morning to late evening. Just outside town, alongside the shore, rose a massive dirt mound that locals said concealed a mysterious ancient structure. They theorized this because during heavy rains, little clay figurines and pieces of pottery washed down the hillside. Recently, archaeologists had been made aware of the mound, and an excavation was planned. Chapala was an idyllic spot in which to relax, almost too pleasant for the disciplines required of writing, too sleepy. Jack and my father would immerse themselves in their writing nonetheless. Our two-story adobe and white stucco house, which had been converted to a duplex, stood on a hillside a block above the shores of the lake. Whenever the men were riding, usually from mid-morning to late afternoon, they enforced strict silence throughout the premises. The house had a long outside corridor where I played with my toys, especially a little army tank. I was in the habit of simulating war noises, and as I immersed myself in fantasy and made too much commotion, Jack or Dad would bellow from one of the rooms, "Silencio," "Silence," or "Cállate, niño," "Shut up, boy." Dad was at his typewriter in one room clacking away, while Jack labored in another room, writing longhand passages that would subsequently be transcribed into typewritten form by Norma. In Mexico, Jack and Dad plotted several stories together, but for a variety of reasons, never completed them. Jack did go on to write and sell a solo novel based upon an idea the men developed together. The men, while fast friends, were perhaps too individualistic to write in concert. They were, each of them, assertive and dominant, alpha males, and at the time they had divergent writing styles. Jack's imagery and skill with words were ahead of Frank Herbert's choppier abilities, although Dad was fast developing in those realms and was also learning characterization and plotting. Of key importance, he was beginning to understand the importance of getting inside a character's head, as he liked to say later. Once a writer got sufficiently inside a character's head, my father discovered, the characters behaved in a manner that was consistent with his personality. Motivations were no longer muddled, and his actions made sense to the reader. Plots fell into place. In Chapala, Frank Herbert was hard at work on Under Pressure, his submarine thriller. The unfolding novel described, with great psychological insight, a submarine crew in wartime, a plot constructed with building blocks that the author had learned about human motivation. Of equal interest, the story described a world of the future where oil supplies were limited. This was not easy to envision at the time, since petroleum products were plentiful and inexpensive. For the concept, Dad recalled that oil had been of strategic importance in World War II, and he extrapolated this to another war, under much more severe conditions. But the novel was progressing slowly, and to pay immediate bills, Dad worked primarily on short stories. They could be finished and mailed in a much shorter period of time, and if they sold, checks would appear. The kitchen of our house was permeated with diffused tropical light, making it a cheerful room. A wooden table sat by one window, and a large basket of fruit was always on the table. I made daily trips to the outdoor market stalls with Mom or our maid Paulina. A fine cook, the maid regularly made a seafood stew that my parents and the Vances liked. There were flies everywhere, and with the exception of Mom, we grew somewhat accustomed to them, even if they crawled across our plates as we were eating. We always examined our food carefully before lifting it mouthward with a fork. Cockroaches were a great concern to us as well, and especially to my mother. Each morning we developed the habit of shaking out our clothes and shoes before putting them on. Many roaches entered through the drain in the bathtub, and if Mom or Norma saw them when they wanted to take a bath, they came out and waggled two fingers, like cockroach antennae, at one of the men. Then Dad or Jack went in and flushed the filthy creatures down the drain with hot water. Sometimes there were as many as 20 roaches at a time. Dad wrote of this and other adventures with Mexican insects in a humorous 1,000-word piece, Life with Animalitos. In Mexico, insects of all kinds are called animalitos, little animals. It was a first-person story, written with Reader's Digest in mind, since they paid well for such material. Unfortunately, this yarn, like a number of others from the pen of Frank Herbert, did not find a receptive editor. I was tutored by my mother, using school books brought from the United States. She taught me Spanish as well, and what she didn't teach me, I learned from children in the streets. By Mexican standards, the cost of living was high in Chapala, and money was running low. Short story sales weren't coming through for my father, and Jack wasn't doing much better. Jack also lost one of his steadiest sources of income, the Captain Video TV show. It was decided that we could get by on less in a non-tourist environment. After 2 months in Chapala, we moved to another town in the state of Jalisco and a few miles south, Ciudad Guzmán. With a population of 24,000, it was considerably larger than Chapala. In Ciudad Guzmán, we rented a smaller two-story adobe and white stucco house. It was in the midst of town, on a level street where the houses were lined up side by side, with small yards. Dad, recalling his farm upbringing, wanted to raise his own food and become as self-sufficient as he could. So he purchased a number of baby chickens, which he kept in an adobe-walled outdoor compound on the street side of the house. Some of the rooms in the house had earthen floors. I remember the loamy odors of earth there, and market smells, and donkeys in the streets swatting flies from their flanks with their tails. The outdoor markets bustled with activity. By now I was proficient in Spanish, so my parents decided to place me in Mexican public school in the first grade. I wore a thin white peasant outfit like local children and carried my school supplies in a small canvas bag. I traveled to and from school on a unique school bus, an old station wagon with some of its windows broken out, including the back one. This allowed motor exhaust into the passenger compartment. I sat in the rear, probably the worst seat from the standpoint of air quality, scrunched up next to other kids. We had been in Ciudad Guzmán for only a few days when the retired Mexican Army general who ran the town asked to see Frank Herbert in order to evaluate his application for an extended stay in Mexico. One of the local merchants took Dad in a truck to the general's beautiful three-story house, where flowers hung from wrought-iron balconies. The general was very friendly. Several people were in attendance, and sweet cookies were served, which Dad liked. He ate two, realizing later that the others only took one apiece. When Dad returned to the merchant's truck, he began to feel drunk. He told the merchant to go get their wives. They were going out to have a party. The merchant wanted no part of this, for he knew they would get into trouble. He told Dad that the cookies had been laced with the most expensive North African hashish in the world, flown in by the Mexican Air Force for the general. Dad recalled being taken into a beautiful building and guided up a long flight of stairs to a room with a table. There, the merchant and a beautiful woman filled him with 6 or 7 cups of strong Mexican coffee. Dad came down from his hallucination and noticed the woman was an old hag, a whorehouse madam. He left as soon as he could, and while descending the stairs, noticed now that they smelled of urine and that there was a stench of burro dung outside. Another time, a Mexican friend gave my father a cup of tea made with semillas, seeds, and Dad didn't think to ask what sort of seeds they were. After consuming the delicious beverage, he learned they were morning glory seeds. Subsequently, he passed out, falling into a pleasant sleep. He recalled my mother waking him up the next morning in a sunny room. A few months later, upon returning to the United States, Dad would have a third and final experience with a hallucinatory drug. While the first two experiences were inadvertent, the third, as I will explain later, was not. Through these experiences, he was developing an awareness of the significance of drugs in human life, and would write about this one day in the Dune series. The fictional spice mélange, the most important substance in the universe, was produced only on the planet Dune, and Paul Atreides's experiences with that drug mirror the author's personal experiences. Mélange, in fact, would become the key to an entire political, economic, and religious structure in the Dune universe. In Ciudad Guzman, with no money coming in, our funds soon ran dangerously low. We packed and left town for parts north. By the end of 1953, we were staying with the Vances at their farmhouse in Kenwood, California. On a small kitchen table at the rear of the house, Mom worked with me on a scrapbook about the Mexico trip. She located a stamp pad and large rubber letters, which we used with painstaking slowness to print a story on the pages. This was one of my first writing experiences, and it was in effect a journal, albeit a brief one. These are some of the entries. We and the Vances got the jeep to go to Mexico, and we went to Colton, California, in the jeep, and we stayed there for 2 days. We went to Nogales, and we went swimming. We stayed in Guaymas for one night. We stayed in Los Mochis and slept in the jeep. Bruce and I were sweating in the hot night. Dad played a double-reed harmonica in those days, favoring sea shanties, Irish songs, and Western tunes. He played Greensleeves, too, which may have been written by one of our ancestors, King Henry VIII. My father's harmonica tone was sweet, with excellent tremolo effect. He could play the guitar and piano as well, with more than passable skill, and he whistled beautifully. Worried Man Blues and Rhapsody in Blue were among his favorites. He had a natural ear and was self-taught. Above all, Frank Herbert was blessed with a wonderful baritone singing voice, rich and full. My mother commented often on how much she enjoyed hearing him sing. He was between jobs at the time, and a number of bill collectors were hot on his trail. One day, my father vowed, he would pay all the old bills in full with interest. For the moment, however, they would have to wait. Chapter 8. The South Sea's Dream. While we stayed with the Vances in California, Dad wasn't doing much creative writing. For several years he had been wanting to return to the Northwest, and now he had feelers out for jobs in Washington State and Oregon, either in the newspaper business or other professions that involved writing. To get by, my parents borrowed money from Mom's Aunt Ruth and Uncle Bing, who lived in nearby Sebastopol, California. In the spring of 1954, when Dad was 33 years old, he obtained an important job. It was as speechwriter for Guy Cordon, a U.S. senator from Oregon who was running for re-election that year. Cordon chaired the Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, with substantial responsibilities in government land use policy. He also sat on the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee and on a number of subcommittees, including Armed Services and Atomic Energy. Years before in Burley, Frank Herbert had been influenced by Henry W. Stein, an ex-newspaperman who spoke of the romance of life on a big city newspaper. Stein also instilled in the boy a passionate interest in politics. Stein had been involved in state and national politics, serving as a presidential elector from the state of Washington. Now my father jumped at the opportunity to join Corden's staff. This would vault him into elite circles, providing his developing intellect with important insights into the mechanics of national politics. Insights that Frank Herbert could use extensively in his writing for years to come. Initially, he would work in Washington, D.C. with the senator, but for only a 6-week period between early April and the primary election in May. After that, Dad was to return to Portland, Oregon, to handle publicity and other tasks for the re-election campaign. Under those circumstances, it wasn't practical for us to accompany him to the nation's capital. We packed at fanatical speed to move our household to Portland, and within 72 hours, everything we owned was ready to go. Then, as always, my parents owned a lot of books, so this made up a great deal of the weight of the shipment. Dad made arrangements for men to come in and carry the items. 2 days later, with only a few suitcases, we were 600 miles north in Portland, staying in a hotel. Corden's previous speechwriter had resigned on short notice, so Dad was needed right away. He only had 1 day to help Mom find an old house to rent in the city. That evening, Mom, Bruce, and I accompanied the new political staffer to Portland Airport. My parents kissed, and Mom said to Dad, "Give 'em hell, darling." My mother would not listen to the radio until hours later, when she was certain his plane had landed safely in Washington, D.C. A man of ethics, with a perfect senatorial attendance record, Guy Corden had been in office for a decade. Like ex-President Harry S. Truman, his close friend in the other major party, he refused to become obligated to private interests. Since Corden was chairman of the Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, oil companies were always trying, without success, to curry favor with him. He was a nuts and bolts man, a technician who cared more about substance than politics. Many times he avoided publicity. My father would grow to respect him very much. In a magazine article, Frank Herbert wrote, "Senator Corden carries a full mane of gray hair which lends an air of dignity to a face dominated by a pair of intense but twinkling eyes. There's something homespun and basically solid about the senior senator from Oregon." My parents wrote to one another, but Mom had more time to write than he did. Her letters were more frequent and longer. One thing was common to all of their correspondents. They spoke of how much they missed one another, how much they ached to be together again. Each evening my mother liked to read, or would knit while listening to Fulton Lewis Jr. or Paul Harvey on the radio. The oil furnace didn't heat the house enough for her, so she liked to bundle up in an afghan and sit by a cozy fire. She read murder mysteries, historical accounts, and, increasingly, books about politics. She was fascinated by biographies of American political leaders, including Eisenhower and Stevenson, and analyses of events that led to the First and Second World Wars. In April and May 1954, the Army-McCarthy hearings were in full swing in Washington, D.C. Radio broadcasts began at 2 o'clock p.m. Portland time, and Mom listened to every one of them. She was a fine seamstress, and using a sewing machine borrowed from Babe, she made curtains for the house, along with her own slacks, shorts, blouses, skirts, and dresses. She also knitted sweaters for Dad. In every way possible, she wanted to help Dad on the Corden campaign, either with advice based upon her political researches, or through other campaign-related tasks that he needed completed in Oregon. She was always volunteering to do things for him, and he very much appreciated it. She located news accounts from papers all over Oregon about Democrat Richard Neuberger, who would probably be Corden's opponent for the Senate seat after the May primaries. Using all available information on Neuberger, my father then prepared speeches and press releases that attacked the opponent's positions on a variety of issues. Public opinion polls came in showing Neuberger doing too well, and as panic set in on the Corden staff, some of them discussed tactics that could only be classified as dirty politics. My father refused to participate in any of those schemes, and instead recommended a course of direct confrontation with Neuberger on the issues. Corden followed this advice, but seemed uncomfortable campaigning. With his aversion to publicity, his accomplishments and messages did not always reach the attention of the voters.
Corden had done a great deal to promote the interests of Oregon labor. For example, by saving a Columbia River Dam construction project in committee. But few people outside of the U.S. Senate ever learned about it.
Frank Herbert had taken on a formidable task, attempting to publicize a man who would not blow his own horn, a man who was widely respected by his peers in the U.S. Senate, but not well known in his own state. In two earlier U.S. Senate elections, Corden had won easily against weak Democratic opponents. Now, in Neuberger, he faced a former state senator and published writer who was easily recognized in Oregon. His wife, state legislator Maureen Neuberger, aided his cause with her own personal popularity, having been a champion of consumer protection issues. Maureen Neuberger was also one of the first politicians to oppose the tobacco industry, and became only the third woman elected to the U.S. Senate herself. In a very real sense, Mom missed Dad so terribly that she tried to keep herself busy while he was gone. She was always asking him on the telephone and in letters when he would be home, and telling him she was keeping the home fires burning. Whenever the phone rang, she ran for it, hoping it was him, hoping he would surprise her with a call from Portland Airport. Whenever she heard footsteps on the front porch, she thought they might be his. When they spoke on the phone, I sometimes saw tears in her eyes, and as they closed, she often said to him in Spanish, "Adios, mi amor." Goodbye, my love. Dad, who was living in a $5-a-day room at the historic Mayflower Hotel, missed her just as much. As days away from her passed, he wrote in a letter home that he had been singing the words from a popular song to himself. "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child." They counted the days remaining until my father would come home. While in Washington, D.C., he obtained a pass through Senator Corden's office and attended a number of the Army-McCarthy hearings. Dad sat in the Senate Reserved Gallery amidst much security, since five members of Congress had been wounded a short time before by Puerto Rican separatists who fired pistols from a spectator's gallery. Senator Corden had been criticized by Neuberger for not coming out against Senator Joseph McCarthy, and this was hurting Corden's campaign, dropping him in the polls. To counter this, Frank Herbert was sitting in on the hearings, obtaining information that Corden might use to advantage. Corden, former Oregon state commander of the American Legion, was strongly pro-military and concurred with many of McCarthy's publicly expressed positions. But troubling bits of information were reaching Corden's ears concerning the methods of the senator from Wisconsin. On his maternal side, Frank Herbert was a McCarthy himself, with many relatives in Senator McCarthy's home state, including the famous Red Bader himself, who was a distant cousin. Dad referred to him as Cousin Joe, and on one occasion they met in the nation's capital at a cocktail party. After initially keeping an open mind about McCarthy, Dad was appalled to learn about blacklisting methods the senator used to prevent suspected communists and communist sympathizers from working in their chosen professions, particularly since this was often based upon scant evidence. Frank Herbert, like McCarthy, felt the leadership of the Soviet Union was psychotic enough to start a nuclear war, but believed McCarthy had gone too far in his zeal and paranoia, to the point where he was endangering essential freedoms of the people of the United States. Here my father drew the line, for he was a great believer in the constitution of this nation, particularly in the rights of individuals. After consideration, he recommended that Corden make a strong statement against McCarthy, which Corden did. But he didn't do it until the hearings were almost over, which Neuberger used against him. At the hearings, Dad saw Robert F. Kennedy working as an aide to Senator McCarthy, talking in hushed tones with the senator, doing the senator's bidding, constantly at his side. This, when added to RFK's later position in support of federal wiretapping, branded him as a dangerous politician, in my father's opinion, as a politician who, like Senator McCarthy, would not hesitate to trample on human rights for the sake of a pet cause. In the Dune series, which would begin in serial form in 1963, Dad wrote extensively about the abuses of power by leaders. These were opinions based, in large degree, upon his experiences in Washington, D.C. Another reflection of this time can be found in the short story Committee of the Whole, which would appear in the April 1965 issue of Galaxy. In that story, Frank Herbert described, in highly cynical terms, the workings of a Senate committee. Dad worked for Senator Corden in room 130A of the Senate office building. The building was commonly referred to as the SOB, and Corden's big office, as staffers called it, was room 333. My father's days were long, often from early in the morning until midnight. Almost every day he had breakfast in the SOB dining room, usually a poached egg on unbuttered wheat toast, a half grapefruit without sugar, and 2 cups of black coffee. He read 3 newspapers with breakfast, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and in great detail, the Congressional Record. He scanned for items of interest and read quickly, a style of research that would be beneficial to him during his long writing career. After breakfast, he liked to take a constitutional around the Capitol building, and shortly before 8:30 a.m., he always reported to room 130A. Dad was much more than a speechwriter to the senator. Each morning after organizing his papers, Dad went up to the 3rd floor to consult with Robert Parkman, Senator Corden's administrative assistant, on promotional projects for the day. Then he went back downstairs and worked on speeches, political letters, and news stories about the senator for release to the press. Speech writing took up most of his time and involved many rewrites. He worked on this for most of each morning and often into the early part of the afternoon. At least 4 lunches each week were with important people, including Secretary of the Interior Douglas McKay, a friend and supporter of Corden. Frank Herbert knew McKay from years earlier in Salem, Oregon, when the younger man had been a reporter and McKay had been a state senator. Other lunches and important meetings were with research directors at the Defense Department for the Army Corps of Engineers, with National Archives people, with Senator Margaret Chase Smith, whom Dad admired, and with Jack Martin, press secretary to President Eisenhower, all to obtain assistance for the Corden campaign. From mid-afternoon to 6 p.m., Dad could invariably be found in the Library of Congress, in what he called his second office. That was study room 249 in the Library of Congress annex. The little room came equipped with telephone extension 807, where he could always be reached if someone needed him right away. Usually he took his portable Remington typewriter into that office. With piles of books and periodicals all around, he researched and wrote speeches, political letters, and press releases. To add spice to the senator's speeches, my father included familiar quotations and anecdotes of famous people, particularly American politicians with a sense of humor, such as Chauncey M. Depew. Depew, renowned as a raconteur and after-dinner speaker, wrote an autobiography, My Memories of 80 Years, which Dad referred to often. The Library of Congress, in 2 huge buildings by the Capitol, was the largest reference facility in the nation, with more than 33 million documents. As a senatorial staffer, Frank Herbert had C-9 security clearance. This permitted him access to the Legislative Reference Service, through which he could use virtually any document or book in the library. He just got on the telephone, ordered what he wanted, and presently it arrived in a cart, with blue bookmarks designating the pages that were of interest to him. Additional notes were included on material available at other government facilities, such as the National Archives. If Dad wanted any of the material, he just ordered it through the Library of Congress, and presently it was in front of him. He had so much research to do, so much studying, that at times he felt like he was cramming for a college examination. In a moment of late-night silliness, he wrote to Mom, referring to the library as the Liberace of Congress. Despite his schedule, remarkably, he found time to write science fiction, and that year a number of his short stories were published. One, Pack Rat Planet, Astounding Science Fiction, December 1954, was an extrapolation of his experiences in the Library of Congress. It described a huge galactic library built into underground chambers that took up almost the entire subsurface of the Earth. All inhabitants of the planet worked in some fashion for the library, and were referred to by the inhabitants of other planets as pack rats, tending vast storehouses of useless information. This was later expanded into the novel Direct Descent, Ace, 1980. Dad made friends with Corden's secretary, Dorothy Jones, and her husband, Lyle. The Joneses had lived in American Samoa and were interested in accompanying us to Mexico on another trip. My father was becoming especially obsessed with the idea of living in American Samoa. If he could obtain a government job there, he thought it would leave him plenty of free time to write. So in his spare time, he had been putting out feelers, letting people know he wanted to live there with his family. Through Corden, Dad met Stuart French, chief counsel of the Subcommittee on Interior and Insular Affairs. French, a powerful man in Washington, D.C., became a personal friend and invited Frank Herbert to his home on a number of occasions. French promised to help Dad obtain an appointment in American Samoa after the U.S. elections were concluded. Since U.S. territories were administered by the Department of the Interior, Dad also told Secretary of the Interior McKay of his interest. McKay said he would do what he could, again after the re-election of Corden. My mother was at first hesitant at the prospect of going to Samoa. She felt Dad should concentrate on the Corden campaign and worry about future assignments afterward. Gradually, though, she came around to his way of thinking. She liked warm climates, and Portland was decidedly on the cool side much of the time. During his stay in the nation's capital, Dad made a train trip to New York City, his first visit there. As he wandered around in the forest of buildings, staring upward, he felt like a country bumpkin. He stayed at the Biltmore Hotel on Madison Avenue and met his literary agent, Lurton Blassingame, for the first time. Lurton was a thin man who looked like an Oxford professor. Meeting Lurton was not, however, the principal purpose of Dad's trip, which was made on behalf of the Corden re-election committee. On the top floor of a New York City office building, Dad tried to convince Paul Smith, board chairman of Collier's Magazine, to run an article on Corden. By prearrangement, the article would be written by a well-known writer and former advisor to Franklin D. Roosevelt, Ray Moley, who would also promise to write several other newspaper and magazine pieces on behalf of the senator. Smith made no commitment beyond a promise to watch for the article when it came in, whereupon he would read it himself. It would not have to go through the usual slush pile route of unsolicited submissions. Frank Herbert saw the slush pile at Collier's and found it disquieting. At a later writing workshop recorded by his friend Bill Ransom, Dad said the slush pile was in a large room, dominated by a long table with big blackboards covering two walls. Mailmen came in pushing large carts full of manuscripts. These submissions were dumped on the table. College students working part-time then sorted the manuscripts, usually distributing them randomly into readers' boxes. There were messages on the blackboards, and the sorters pulled out anything that particular editors said they were looking for. Some writers were mentioned negatively, with their manuscripts tossed in a rejection sack. Envelopes that looked unprofessional were tossed directly into the rejection sack without being opened. These unfortunate writers would receive form letters, often after long delays. When Ray Moley learned that Collier's wasn't offering a contract in advance, he refused to write the article. "Nothing on speculation," he said. So, prompted by Corden, Dad took on the writing chore and set to work on it in the Library of Congress. The completed article, entitled Undersea Riches for Everybody, was 4,000 words long, a popular length at Collier's, and described problems of underwater oil and gas exploration on the continental shelf. It outlined Corden's position on this issue, and if published in time, was expected to boost the campaign. Dad completed it in a few days and rushed it to Lurton for submission to Paul Smith.
In order to make each proposal more noticeable to an editor, Lurton always submitted it in an orange folder with an agency label bearing the story title and name of the author.
An astute judge of talent, Lurton encouraged my father and assured him, "You'll be a big name before too long." The agent became something of a father figure to Frank Herbert and a tremendous inspiration. He was also a no-nonsense man who said what was on his mind. Lurton's brother, Wyatt Blassingame, was an award-winning short story writer who also offered advice and encouragement. Wyatt's work had appeared frequently in national magazines and anthologies. He had written pulp science fiction as well, with such memorable titles as Ghouls of the Green Death, 1934, and The Goddess of Crawling Horrors, 1937. Lurton wanted very much to see Dad's novel completed, the psychological thriller about submarine warfare that he had begun a couple of years before in Santa Rosa. But that writing project had been derailed by the necessity of survival. At least my father had a job, for the time being. That was not always the case during the years I lived with him.
The subjects Dad researched for Corden were varied, and would form a basis not only for the senator's speeches, but for the political-ecological writings of Frank Herbert in the next four decades.
He researched Tidelands Oil, the Submerged Lands Act, the Continental Shelf Lands Act, land grants, an Oil for Education congressional amendment, federal aid to education, issues of grazing on national forest lands, and the highly publicized Hell's Canyon issue involving construction of a huge hydroelectric project on the Snake River. Sometimes, Dad wrote committee reports on Senate bills for Corden. He also analyzed Corden's voting record in detail on environmental, educational, agricultural, power development, and other issues. With this information, he prepared abstracts of the senator's comments for press releases and other purposes, slanted to show how Corden's positions were benefiting people in the state of Oregon. Guy Corden, a strong influence on my father, believed in reducing government spending and in limiting the size and power of bureaucratic institutions. Between 1947 and 1951, the senator voted to cut all federal appropriations, to cut non-defense spending, to reduce government publicity expenditures, and to reduce government employee benefits. He voted to limit the President of the United States to two terms in office. Corden also advocated state instead of federal control over offshore resources, and opposed federal construction of massive public power facilities, positions that were directly at odds with those of Neuberger. One of Senator Corden's most important speeches, involving what was known as the Hill Amendment, was 16 pages long and involved wading through nearly 50 documents. Dad worked all night to complete it, and bleary-eyed, showed up with it at Corden's office at 9 o'clock one morning. He found the door to the senator's inner office closed, which usually meant an important visitor was inside. But Corden's secretary told Dad to go right in with the speech. Upon entering, he noticed a man in a Homburg hat seated with his back to him. The man had his feet on Corden's desk. Something was very familiar about the hat. Frank Herbert said, "Here's your speech, Senator," and was about to leave when he realized that the visitor was ex-President Harry S. Truman. Corden introduced them and they shook hands. Truman said something to the effect that he hoped it was a good speech, and Dad, flabbergasted, beat a hasty retreat. Corden and Truman were buddies, despite being in different political parties. Both men were outspoken individualists. At the time, Truman had retired from public life and was working on his memoirs. After reading the speech, Corden took Dad to lunch and told him it was a powerful piece of paper and one of the best damned research jobs he had ever seen. Dad got another raise. The speech was ingenious, and in writing it, my father called upon a technique he had learned in the newspaper business. Neither Corden nor anyone on his staff had ever seen anything like it. Using what newspaper men called the concentric circles technique, Dad wrote the speech so that it could be cut from the end in a number of places, thus making successively shorter and shorter speeches. A variety of lengths could be chosen, and each time the length was expanded, it enlarged upon the arguments in the central theme, making it more and more convincing. One evening late in May, so that primary voting for our neighborhood could be held in our house, Mom moved the furniture and rugs out of the front hall, living room, and dining room, and scrubbed the floors. Balloting booths were moved in. 2 days later, on the morning of the election, a number of election officials arrived. I remember standing in the living room in a thick forest of adults who towered over me, all of whom were talking politics. At the time, I was just getting over the measles. Mom took us out to a restaurant for dinner, while the heaviest election crowds were in the house. Corden won the Republican primary as expected, and my father returned to Portland in June. At our dinner table, he spilled forth stories of important people he had met or heard about. He spoke of a faraway place called Washington, D.C., and of distant lands he wanted to visit, such as American Samoa. He called Samoa paradise, and showed us romantic color photographs from books and magazines of palm trees, thatched huts, and sailing boats. "We're going to live there soon," he announced. My half-sister Penny, by Dad's first marriage, came to visit us late in the summer of 1954. 12 years old, she wanted to spend time with her father, and despite the fact that he remained in arrears on his child support payments, her mother assented. That August, Dad received terrific news. Colliers wanted to publish his article and were paying well for it, $1,250. Dad was elated. Through Lurton, he tried to get assurance that Underseas Riches would appear in time to help Corden's re-election campaign. Dad felt strongly that the Neuberger side was engaging in a smear campaign, spreading false information about Corden's positions on issues. Neuberger had a way of coloring the facts, of distorting them to his advantage. In the Corden campaign, it was hoped that the article, in a popular magazine, would help set the record straight. Months went by, however, and the election occurred first. The article, while paid for by Colliers, was shunted aside for nearly 3 years and never did appear in the magazine. Ultimately, the publication folded. The 1954 national elections were held on Tuesday, November 2nd. Oregon returns were slow coming in, since they only had one voting machine in the entire state. Consequently, the vast majority of votes had to be tabulated by hand. After polls closed in the state, Corden held a slight lead, and it increased slowly all night long until he was 12,000 votes ahead. He showed surprising early strength in heavily Democratic Multnomah County. When Neuberger went to bed late that night, he thought he had lost the election. Corden wasn't so certain. He called it a horse race. During the following morning and early afternoon, Corden's lead shrank. The election was so close that the governor ordered the placement of guards on all ballot boxes to prevent vote tampering. By 2:30 p.m., Neuberger was only 1,800 votes behind. 2 hours later, he took the lead. The margin then increased by ones and twos and tens, and kept increasing. When all votes were tabulated, Senator Cordon carried 26 of 36 counties, but still lost the election by less than 0.4%, since he didn't carry the most populous counties. It was the closest U.S. Senate race in the nation, and the most dramatic election in Oregon history. Thereafter, Frank Herbert put more effort into obtaining a position in American Samoa, where he believed the slow, laid-back lifestyle would fit into the vision he had for his life. Adding to government material on the South Seas that he had shipped back from Washington, D.C., he purchased books about American Samoa and other trust territories, including a book about interesting archaeological ruins at Ponape, also known as Pohnpei, and formerly Ascension Island, in the Caroline Islands. Dad's application for a government position went through channels to William Strand, director of the Office of Territories. Secretary of the Interior McKay and others put in recommendations in support of it. Strand, however, had the final word. He apparently felt my father was overqualified for the position, and that he would not remain in it long before wanting to devote full time to other pursuits. Strand may have been correct in this assessment, and it may have been based upon an offhand comment made by someone who knew my father, a comment to the effect that his first love was writing. Maybe Dad told too many people about his creative interests, and word got out that he wouldn't be a good government man. Dad turned his attentions to his writing. He had sold more short stories in 1954 than in any previous year, along with the lucrative sale to Collier's. He had in mind a novel based upon his experiences working for Senator Cordon, but for the moment, he was sour on politics. The unfinished submarine thriller was at hand, the novel Lurton wanted to see. Lurton also wanted more science fiction short stories. So, with our funds dwindling once again, Dad set to work on the submarine novel. A few days before Christmas, 1954, we rented a little A-frame beach cabin in Healy Palisades, Washington. This was a tiny community between Seattle and Tacoma, in an area now known as Federal Way. The rent was low, and well it should have been. The cabin, all 600 square feet of it, was at the bottom of a steep hill, reached by a long narrow trail. We moved in by boat, using a large open dory powered by an inboard diesel engine. This was supposed to be an interim house, a cheap place to live until Dad finished his submarine novel Under Pressure. Dad set to work on the book, rising early each day and working far into the night. My mother began to do freelance copy editing for local stores, writing retail advertisements to bring in what money she could. Mom's work was only part-time, paying very little. To reduce family expenditures, she removed frayed collars from our shirts and sewed the collars back on inside out, giving new life to old fabric. She also cut long sleeves down to short when the elbows became worn, and patched our socks and the knees of trousers. To save money, my father regularly gave his sons what he called butch haircuts, using electric clippers. These were crew cuts, with our hair cut the same length all over. His haircuts turned out okay at first, but always looked funny in a few weeks when the hair grew out. I had cowlicks, and as time passed without a new trim, my head took on the shape of a large, strange flower. The proverbial church mouse had more money than we did in those days. When we didn't have enough on hand to pay bills, Mom developed a random method of deciding which would receive priority. She threw all of them on the floor, and the ones that landed right side up were paid first. On other occasions, she drew bills out of Dad's Homburg felt hat to determine which ones to pay. For my principal chore, I was assigned to collect driftwood from the beach to heat the house. I found quite a bit, which I stacked on the porch by the front door. Dad did his own foraging for firewood, and he supplemented that by getting on as many mailing lists as he could, under a phony name. In a few weeks, junk mail was pouring in from all over the country, which Dad and Mom tossed in the wood stove in the kitchen along with the driftwood, or in a river rock fireplace in the main living area. The junk mail trick continued for a number of years after that, until one day Dad saw a royalty check in the fireplace with flames curling around it. He didn't get to it in time, and had to request reissuance of the check. In ensuing years, he always cursed the arrival of junk mail. Our beach cabin had one bedroom and one bath. I slept on a mattress on the floor of a tiny mezzanine overlooking the living room. Bruce's crib was set up nearby. He was 3, and I was 7. Due to the absence of a wall, activities downstairs often kept me awake, especially Dad's loud voice as he told long, convoluted, shaggy dog stories, and his booming laughter after the punchlines. I often crawled out of bed, and in my pajamas peered through a railing at adults below. Bruce slept through anything. A man of extremes, my father could become very angry, a side of him I saw too often. At the other end of the spectrum, he could behave like the happiest man alive. At such times his laughter was remarkable. It rolled from him in great peals. He savored each cachinnation, taking a couple of extra gulps of mirth at the end. When entertaining guests, my parents often had the lights down low while the fireplace blazed cheerily, giving the cabin a warm glow. A remarkable raconteur, Dad enjoyed talking far into the night. For his desk, Frank Herbert salvaged a broad slab of driftwood from the beach and mounted it on a frame constructed of plywood and 2x4s. It was set up in the living room by a large window so that he looked out upon the water. One day he received an unsolicited package of peyote in the mail from a friend, along with instructions on how to take it. A note with the package said the stuff was guaranteed to cure writer's block. Mom told him not to do it, to throw the stuff away. But Dad was curious. He'd never had peyote before, and proceeded to cut up an entire blossom. With this and hot water, he made a cup of tea. The instructions said to quaff it, and Dad did so. Instantly the stuff came back up, with most of the other contents of his stomach. After cleaning up, Dad didn't feel any ill effect and went back to writing his submarine novel at the driftwood desk. Soon he seemed to be upon the waters of Puget Sound, with sunlight glinting off wave tops in a rhythmic pattern. He experienced sound with each beat of light, an eerie, beautiful pealing. The water was choppy, almost forming white caps, and sunlight glinted upon it. Suddenly he realized he was hearing each glint of light, the most dulcet, soothing chimes he had ever experienced in his life. Thus, when he wrote in the Dune series of A Vision Echo, he was writing from first-hand experience, from an experience of sensory mixing. My father discarded the rest of the peyote and never did anything like that again. He said the regurgitation was caused by strychnine, a white, fluffy material that should have been separated from the blossom's bud with a knife and thrown away. Before we moved again in early 1955, Dad returned the driftwood desktop slab to the beach. He told my mother he had been the custodian of the wood for a short time. Years later, he would say something similar to me, that none of us ever own land. We are merely caretakers of it, passing it along one day to other caretakers. It is this way with the earth, he said. We are stewards of it, not owners, and one day future generations will assume the responsibility. Chapter 9. The Family Car. And always he fought the temptation to choose a clear, safe course, warning, that path leads ever down into stagnation. Frank Herbert in Dune. That spring, Dad received a job offer to do promotional work for the Douglas Fir Plywood Association, DFPA, in Tacoma. The position didn't pay much, but with these earnings, we could afford a nicer place to live. Not much of a step upward. We moved into an old ramshackle house on the tide flats of Marine View Drive, across the bay from Tacoma. The weather-beaten house, with a porch that ran around most of it, stood on a narrow stretch of land some 20 feet below road level, reached by going down 2 sets of steps. Part of the structure was on pilings, and below the house was an old dock. For his study, Dad set up a desk in what had once been the living room. This afforded him a view of an industrial waterway, filled with tugboats and log booms. Each evening after work at the DFPA, and every weekend, I heard his portable typewriter going constantly, a rapid machine-gun rhythm of keys. Tacoma had long suffered a reputation for its poor air quality, known as the Tacoma Aroma. A number of pulp mills were in and around the city, and the tall stack of a giant smelter across the bay was visible from our house. From the dumping of arsenic, heavy metals, and other industrial wastes in the bay, the tide flats by us had a distinctive, unpleasant odor, especially when the tide was out. For the 6 months we lived in that house, Bruce and I slept on thin mattresses, on a pair of toboggans set up on an unheated, enclosed porch. 2 of Frank Herbert's science fiction short stories were published that year, Rat Race, Astounding Science Fiction, July 1955, and Occupation Force, Fantastic, August 1955. Earnings from them were minimal. These stories had been written before we moved to Marine View Drive. Now here, with every moment of spare time, he labored on his submarine novel Under Pressure. He finished the 75,000-word book in April 1955 and mailed it to Lurton. It was organized into several story breaks, making it easily adaptable to serialization. When he wrote the book, he had in mind the legendary editor at Astounding Science Fiction, John W. Campbell. Among his other accomplishments, Campbell was a science fiction writer himself. Campbell's 1938 story, Who Goes There, had been turned into a film in 1951, The Thing. The film had one of the most campy promotional lines of all time. A monster so horrible it doesn't even have a name. The Thing. It was remade by John Carpenter in 1982. Even with my father's job, we didn't have much money to spend. Flora knew where we were and wanted her child support money. The IRS demanded payment for back taxes, but in lieu of checks, Dad sent excuses. Other bill collectors were in pursuit as well. Dad did much of the cooking in our household and liked to stir-fry several pounds of rice in a big wok with a few vegetables and a minimal amount of meat. I'm sure it was good for us, with all the complex carbohydrates my father promised. But for years after I moved out, I refused to eat rice. Only recently have I been able to stomach it again. In the mid-1950s, a large new medical facility was opening in Tacoma, the Mary Bridge Children's Hospital. When Mom's freelance copywriting assignment